ladies and gentlemen of all ages, boys and girls. Thank you for tuning in to yet another episode of Angry Meat Production. We appreciate you coming in and letting us be a part of your lives, week in and week out. We hope to do our best to present you with something that your eardrums delight in. Whether you're looking at us on YouTube or Rumble, or listening to us on Spotify, Google, or Anchor, or any of the other podcast services that we are currently on or trying to get on, we thank you. And if you don't mind, at the end of every episode, stop by, leave us a comment, leave us a like. If it asks for 5 stars, we'll take 5 stars, even if you don't like us. 5 stars are what it's all about. With that being said, we hope you enjoy our attempt to make our advocation our vocation. Ladies and gentlemen, let the games begin.
Welcome, Angry Faithful. Today on Psychos and Sociopaths, we're going to go over Whitey Bulger. Whitey Bulger was a organized crime boss in White Hill Gang in White Hill's North Hood of Somerville, Massachusetts, directly northwest of Boston. Take that fucking title off. But on December 23rd, 1994, Bulger fled the Boston area and went into hiding from after his former FBI handler, John Conley, tipped him off about a pending RICO indictment case against him. Bulger remained largely for 16 years after his 2011 arrest. Federal prosecutors tried Bulger 19 murders on a grand jury testimony of Kevin Weeks and other former criminal associates. Now, funny thing about his arrest is, not spoil it on it, but one thing is he was so scared of getting arrested that he thought if he's going to have, like, you know, cancer or something to do in that fashion to where he was about to die, he literally said he was going to go to the Arizona desert, find a cave, and die there. So he would always be not captured. But we're going to go over his life and his criminal activities. And then let's begin. Bulger's father, James Joseph Bulger Sr., was from the Harbor Grace, Newfoundland, now Kevin Province of Newfoundland, and laborer, hailing from Irish parents after settling in Everett, Massachusetts. James Sr. married Jane Victoria Jean McCarthy, first-generation Irish immigrant. Their first child, James Joseph Bulger Jr., was born in 1929. Bulger's father worked as a union laborer and occasional longshoreman. He lost his arm in an industrial accident, and his family reduced poverty after that. In May 1938, Mary Ellen McCurrick Housing Project was opening in the neighborhood of South Boston. The Bulger family moved in, and the children grew up there. The elder Bulger children, Bulger, J.P. Bulger, excelled at school. James Bulger Jr. became drawn to street life, basically wanted to be a gangster or a criminal, whatever you want to say it. Early in his criminal career, local police gave Bulger the nickname Whitey because his blonde hair. Bulger hated the name, which all freaking criminals usually hate their name. Nobody likes their nickname because nicknames usually given by someone else and some doing stupid. Bulger hated the nickname. He preferred to be called Jimmy, Jim, or even Boots. The last nickname came from his habit of wearing cowboy boots, which he used to hide his switchblade. However, the nickname Whitey stuck. Now, throughout his lifetime, starting at age 14, Bulger was arrested and charged with larceny. God, word. Even I'm not gonna lie, this is my second attempt on this, because yesterday I tried to do this and the other day I tried to do this and I was not getting the words right, and it seems that it's carrying over to today, but we're gonna power through it. By then he had joined the street gang known as the Shamrocks. Guess what, they were Irish. And would eventually be arrested for assault, forgery, or armed robbery. Bulger was sentenced to juvenile reform for these crimes. Shortly after his release in 1948, Bulger joined the Air Force, which did not reform. He spent his time in the military prison for several assaults and was later arrested by Air Force police, security forces, nowadays, in 1950 for going absent without leave, AWOL, basically. And nevertheless, he received an honorable discharge, which it's kind of strange. If you met a person with this dishonorable discharge, he did something really fucked up. But starting out in 1956, Bulger served his first term of prison, federal prison, in the Atlanta penitentiary for armed robbery and truck hijacking. So throughout his own lifetime, he's always been a criminal. He later told mobsters Kevin Weeks that while there, he was used as a human subject for the CIA-sponsored MK Ultra. I'm kind of curious on that one. MK Ultra. He was told that the goal was to help find the cure for schizophrenia, but it was actually a research for mind control. By the way, a lot there was. Whitey Bulger was one of the ones that said he was in MK Ultra. Another person was actually that's known for that was the Unabomber. Ted Kandinsky. I think we covered him too. I gotta check that out. Kind of sad. I've been doing this so long now for about a year and a half. I've gone over a lot of messed up people that I've totally went. I've gone over people and I don't remember. So he was given LSD for the MK Ultra program. He felt the recruited, because if you did the MK Ultra program, you would get in a lighter sentence. And he said that recruited by deception, and we're told that we're helping find a cure for schizophrenia. And through the experiments, notebooks Bulger wrote described the terror he felt through the ingestion of the additional doses of LSD. He wrote that he heard voices and feared that if he had admitted this to anyone, he would be committed to life to a actual insane asylum. In 1959, Bulger was briefly transferred to maximum security facility of Alcatraz Federal Penitentiary in California. Later in his sentence, he was transferred to Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary in 1963 at Lindbergh Federal Penitentiary. Berger's third petition for parole in 1965 was granted after he was served a 9-year prison. He would not be arrested for another 46 years. But he actually served in the Clean Mullen War. Basically, it was a war with two rival gangs. Bulger worked as a janitor and construction worker before becoming a bootmaker and loan shark under the mobster Donald Clean, whose gang, the Cleans, had dominated the South Boston for over 20 years. The Cleans were led by three brothers, Donnie, Kenny, and Eddie, along with Billy O'Sullivan and Jack Curran. Their base was the Transit Cafe in South Boston, which was later actually bought out by Whitey, and it's Whitey's Triple O's. In 1971, Clean's younger brother, Kenny allegedly shot and mauled Michael Mickey Dower, a member of the rival Mullen gang, during a brawl in the Transit Cafe. A gang war resulted in this, leading to a string of killings throughout Boston and surrounding suburbs. The Klings quickly found themselves outgunned and outmaneuvered by the younger Mullins. It was during the war that Bulger set out to commit what Weeks described as his first murder of Mullen member Paul McGowan. However, Bulger instead executed McGowan's law-abiding brother, Donald, in the case of mistaken identity. In his statement, although McGowan never did anything, he kept on stringing everyone up with his mouth. So Jimmy decided to kill him. Jimmy shot him right between the eyes. Only it wasn't Polly, it was Donald. Jimmy drove straight to the mobster Billy O'Sullivan's house on Savin Hill Avenue and told O'Sullivan, "I shot the wrong one. I shot Donald." Billy said, "Don't worry about it. He wasn't healthy anyways. He smoked. He was probably going to get lung cancer." That's a legitimate. God, I love how lots of people from that time frame, they'll just go out and just say something like, "Oh, don't worry about it. He was dead already." According to former Mullen boss Pat Neely, McGowan ambushed and murdered O'Sullivan on the assumption he was the one responsible for his brother killing. So he basically ended up getting someone else killed on accident-ish. Man, they were on mob war. Bulger realized he was on the losing side, secretly approaching Howie Winter, the leader of the Winter Hill Gangs, and claimed that he could end the war by murdering the Kling leadership shortly thereafter. And claimed he could end the war shortly thereafter on May 13th, 1972. Donald Kling was gunned down outside his home in the suburbs of Flemington. Neil disputed this, claiming that Kling was murdered by Mullins enforcer James Mandeville and Tommy King, not Bulger. Bulger and the Klings fled Boston, fearing they would be next. Need arranged for a dispute to the mediation by Winter and Joseph Rosso. Cooper Regime of the Patrick Crime Foundry. No, that's not how he's pronounced.
Patriarca Crime Family.
I had it right. In Rhode Island, which is that kind of surprised me, the fact that there is a crime family in Rhode Island. Rhode Island is very small. You don't really think about, you know, mobs and small areas like that. And then sent down at Chandler's nightclub in Boston South End, the Mullins were represented by Neil and King, and the Kling by Bulger. The two Kings joined forces with the Winter, the overall boss. Soon after, Donald's sole surviving brother, Kenny, was jogging in Boston City Point neighborhood when Bulger called him over to his car and said, "It's over, you're out of business, no more warnings." Kenny would later testify that Winter Hill enforcers Steve Fleming and John Monarano were in the car with Bulger. Basically, they were setting it up to where no more killings, but they were telling them not to fucking do anything else, which, you know, safer for everybody, I guess. After the 1972 truce, Bulger and the Mullins were in control of South Boston's criminal underworld. FBI agent Dennis Candon noted that in his log that in September 1973, the Bulgers and Need had been heavily shaking down the neighborhood's bookmakers and loan sharks. Over the years that followed, Bulger began to remove opposition by persuading Winter to sanction the killings of those who stepped out of line. In a 2004 interview, Winter recalled that the highly intelligent Bulger could teach the devil tricks. During this elder, Bulger's victims included the Mulden veterans McGallen, King, and James Spike O'Toole. According to Weeks, as a criminal, he had made a point of not only preying on criminals, but when things couldn't get worked out, tweeting in satisfaction with these people. After all the other options had been explored, he wouldn't hesitate to use violence. Tommy King in 1975 was one example. Tommy's problem began when he and Jimmy had worked in a Triple O's, Bulger's bar. Tommy was a Mullins, made a fist, and Jimmy saw it. A week later, Tommy was dead. Tommy's second and last mistake was getting into a car with Jimmy, Stevie, and Johnny Manano. Later that same night, Jimmy called Buddy Leonard and left him in Tommy's car with Pulaski's Way in the Old Colony projects to confuse authorities. Basically, he was setting it up to where they couldn't figure out where the body was actually killed. They would also take out their teeth so they couldn't be identified, because about that time frame, they didn't have DNA or anything like that. Anti-busting attacks. Another thing that Whitey was, apparently, he was a racist. In late August, early September 1974, Bulger and accomplices reported setting fire to elementary schools in Wesley to intimidate U.S. District Court Judge Wendell Arthur Gritty Jr. over the mandate plan to desegregate schools in the city of Boston by means of busing. 1 year later, on September 8, 1975, Bulger and a unidentified person tossed a Molotov cocktail into JFK birthing place in Brookline in retaliation for Senator Ted Kennedy's vocal support for Boston's schools desegregation. This is the 70s. That's what's really sad. You think that desegregation was actually completed by beginning of the 70s, which it wasn't. Even the northern places didn't desegregate. Bulger used black spray paint and scrolled Bus Teddy on the sidewalk just outside the National Historical Site. In 1971, though, the FBI, Federal Bureau of Investigation, approached Bulger in an attempt to recruit him as an informant as part of their effort against the Patricia crime family. The FBI's special agent, John Connolly, was assigned to make the pitch. However, Connolly failed to win Bulger's trust at the time. 3 years later, Bulger partnered with Fleming, an Italian American mobster who'd been an FBI informant since 1965. Although it was documented the fact that Bulger soon followed Fleming's example, exactly how and why continues to be debated. Colony frequently boasted to his fellow agents about how he had recruited Bulger at a late meeting at Wollaston Beach inside an FBI-issued car. Colony allegedly said that the FBI could help in Bulger's feud with Patricia. God, that's not that name again.
Patriarca.
Underboss Gerardo Angeleno. After listening to the pitch, Bulger is said to have been responded, "All right, if they want to play checkers, we'll play chess. Fuck them." Weeks considered it more likely that Fleming had betrayed Bulger to the FBI, giving the choice to supply information to the Bureau or return to prison. As they already know, Bulger did not want to go back to prison at all. 1997, shortly after the Boston Globe disclosed that Bulger and Fleming had been informants, Weeks met with Colony, who showed him a photograph of Bulger's FBI informant file. In order to explain Bulger and Fleming's status as informants, Colony said the Mafia was going against Jimmy and Stevie. So Jimmy and Stevie went against them. In a 2011 interview, Fleming recalled, "Me and Whitey gave the feds shit, and they gave us gold." According to Weeks, Colony kept telling me that 90% of the information in the file came from Stevie, but Colony told me he had to put Jimmy's name on the file to keep his file active. As long as Jimmy was an active informant, Colony said he could justify meeting with Jimmy and give him valuable information even after he retired. Colony still had friends in the FBI, and he and Jimmy kept meeting to let each other know what was going on. I could see that a lot of the reports were not just against the Italians. There was more and more names of Polish and Irish guys, of people who had done business with, of friends of mine. I would see over and over again that some of these people had been arrested for crimes that mentioned in these reports. It had been bullshit when Colony told me that the files hadn't been dismantled, that they had been for his own personal use. If there was some investigation going on and his supervisor said, "Let me take a look at that," what was Colin going to do? He had to give it up. And he obviously had. The FBI agent, John Morrison, was put in charge of the organizing squad in FBI Boston Files office in 1977. Morrison did not prove himself unable to rein in Colony's protection of Bulger, but even assisted him. By 1982, Morrison was thoroughly compromised, having had Bulger buy plane tickets for his then-girlfriend, Debbie Noseworthy, to visit him in Georgia while he was being trained as a drug investigation, trained for drug investigation. Even in 1983, when Morrison was transferred to head up the Boston FBI Anti-Drug Task Force, he remained an accomplice to Colony and Bulger. In the summer of 1983, the intents of bad blood between the Winter Hill Gang and the Prussian... I keep on messing this
up. Patriarca.
Patriarca family escalated at the all-time high. An employee at Coin-O-Matic, a cash laundry vending machine company owned by Prescienta.
Patriarca
family, known only an employee of the Coin-O-Matic, known as Butch, was kidnapped while working. The Boston Police Department, operating on a tip, raided the butcher shop in South Boston's co-owned by Bulger and two other White Hill members. Boston PD found Butch hanging from a beef rack, having been severely tortured and held for several days. The victim never testified, and all law enforcement documents were redacted for his safety. Law enforcement had hoped he would cooperate fully and then go into witness protection. People familiar with the Coin-O-Matic and its sister company, Vita Vending out of Fritchburg, Massachusetts, knew exactly who the worker was, but the code of silence was still very strong in Boston. Mafia people had a very loose lip type, sink ship type deal. No snitches get stitches, basically. In the next few months, three low-level Winter Hill gang members were executed, mostly believed to be retribution for the kidnapping of Butch, which, sorry, I don't do the same thing. This bloody mob war shined a large spotlight on the FBI agent John Morrison and caused an internal investigation that began with the FBI. In 1988, Bulger's work with the FBI as an FBI informant was heavily publicized in the Globe Spotlight team, led by journalist Gerard O'Neill, published a story detailing his work with the FBI while still actively committing crimes. Bulger committing crimes. Rumors had abandoned long before.
Abounded.
Sorry. Long before then, since it was unheard for a criminal Bulger statue to go for 4 years without even being arrested. So basically, they were coming up with this journalist, Gerard O'Neill, was coming up with the article that showed that Bulger was still doing criminal activities, but he was never arrested, and they knew about these criminal activities. That's how Bulger got was free for so long, because he was technically an FBI informant. He gave information on other gangs' activities and everything, but in the long run, he was still doing murders. Racketeering, stuff like that. Bulger and Fleming were indicted in racketeering charges along with two Boffin mafiosos, Frank Selman and Bobby DeCola. During the discovery phase, Selmy and DeLuca, were listening to tapes from a roving bug.
Roving
bug, which is normally authorized when the FBI has no advanced knowledge of their criminal activities will be taken place. Basically, they bugged the place. They overheard two of the agents who were listening in on the bug mentioning that they should have told one of the informants to give a list of questions to the other wise guys. When their lawyer, Tony
Cardinale
learned about this, he realized that the FBI had lied about the basis of the bug in order to protect the informant. Suspects that this was not the first time this had happened.
Cardinale
sought to force prosecutors to reveal the identities of any informants used in connection with the case. Federal Judge Mark L. Wolf granted Cardinale motion in May 22, 1997. But on June 3rd, Polly E. Caffey, the head of the Organized Crime and Racketeering Section of the Department of Justice, gave a sworn statement admitting that Bulger had been an FBI informant. Caffey stated that since Bulger was accused of leading a criminal enterprise while working as an informant and was now a fugitive, he had forfeited any reasonable expectations that his identity should be protected. On September 5th, 2006, federal judge Ronald J. Lindsay ruled that the mishandling of Bulger's and Fleming's case caused the murder of 1984 murder of informant Johnny mention this. McNary?
McIntyre.
Oh, McIntyre. Awarded the family $3.1 million in damages. Lindsay stated that the FBI failed to properly supervise Colony, who was eventually convicted and jailed in 2002, and stuck his head in the sand regarding numerous allegations that Bulger and Fleming were involved in drug trafficking, murder, and other criminal for decades. Okay. During this time, of its downfall in April 1994, a joint task force of the DEA and the Boston Police and the Massachusetts State Police launched a probe of Bulger's illegal gambling operations. The FBI, by the time considered composed, was not informed. After a number of bookmakers agreed to testify to having paid protection money to Bulger, the federal case was billed against him under the Racketeering, Influencing, Corruption Organization Act, basically RICO case. That's what RICO case is, Racketeering, Influence, and Corruption Organization. That's one thing I didn't know. According to Weeks, in 1993 and 1994, before pitching pitches came down, Jimmy and Stevie were traveling on a French and Italian Riviera. The two had been traveling over Europe, sometimes separate for a while, and sometimes they took the girls. Sometimes they just went. The two of them would just went. They were would rent cars, travel all through Europe. It was more preparation for than anything, getting ready for another life. They didn't ask me to go, but that I would have to want to. Jimmy had preparation for a run for years. He had established a whole other person, Tom Baxter, and completed ID credit cards in his name. He had even joined an association in Baxter's name, building an entire profile for the guy. He had always said you had to be ready to take off on a short notice, and he was. Bulger had also set up safety deposit boxes containing cash, jewelry, passports, and locations all across North America and Europe, including Florida, Oklahoma, Montreal, Dublin, London, Brigham Young, and Venice. In the December 1994, he had informed by Colony that civil indictments had been coming from the Department of Justice and that the FBI was set to make an arrest during the Christmas season. In response, Bulger fled Boston on December 23rd, 1994, accompanied by his common-law wife, Teresa Stanley. After fleeing Boston, Bulger and Stanley spent 4 days over Christmas in Selden.
In Selden.
Selden, New York, before spending New Year's Day in a hotel in New Orleans, French Quarter. On January 5th, 1995, Bulger prepared to return to Boston, believing that he had been he had a false alarm. That night, however, Fleming was arrested outside a Boston restaurant and, by the DEA. Boston Police Detective Michael Fleming, Stephen's brother, informed Weeks of the arrest. Weeks immediately passed the information on to Bulger, who altered his plans. Bulger and Stanley, Teresa, spent the next 3 weeks traveling New York City, Los Angeles, and San Francisco before Stanley decided that she wanted to return to her children. They traveled to Clearwater, Florida, where Bulger retrieved his Tom Baxter identification from a safety deposit box. He then drove to Boston and dropped off Stanley in a parking lot. Bulger met in, with Weeks at Malibu Beach in Dorchester, where Weeks brought Bulger's girlfriend, Catherine Greed. Greg. Thanks, Greg.
Get the words. Greg.
Yeah, Greg. Bulger and Greg then went on to on the run together. In his memoirs, Weeks described a clandestine meeting with Bulger and Greg in Chicago. Bulger reminisced fondly about his time hiding out with his family in Louisiana. He told Weeks he had replaced him as the head of the Winter Hill Gang. If anything comes down, put it on me. As they endured to nearby Japanese restaurant, Bulger finally revealed how exhausted he was for his life on the run. He told Weeks, every day out, there is another day I beat them. Every good meal is a meal I can't take they can't take away from me. In the middle of November 1995, Weeks and Bulger met for the last time in the Lion statue in front of New York Public Library in Man Branch. Enduring for dinner at the nearby restaurant, according to Weeks. At the end of our dinner, he seemed more aware of everything around him. His tone was a little bit more serious, and there wasn't much joking as usual. He repeated the phrase he had used before that Rolling Stone gathering, "No Moss," which told me he knew he was going to be on the move again. I got the feeling that he was resigning himself to the fact that he wasn't coming back. Up until then, I always believed he thought there was a chance he would beat the case. However, at the that point, there was something different going on with him. I didn't fully understand all aspect of his case. It would be another 6 months before it came clear. Yet at that moment in that restaurant in New York, I sensed that he had moved to a new place in his mind, and it was over. He'd never returned to South Boston. On November 17th, 1999, Weeks was arrested by the combined forces of DEA and Manchester, Massachusetts State Police, although by this time, he was aware of Bulger's FBI deal. He had determined to remain faithful to the neighborhood code of silence. However, while awaiting trial in Rhode Island, Wyatt Federal Prison, Weeks was approached by a fellow inmate, a made man in the park. I'm going to mess up their name each and every time.
Patriarca
family, who told them, "Kid, what are you doing? Are you going to take it up the ass for these guys? Remember, you can't rat a rat. And those guys have been giving up everyone for 30 years. In the aftermath, we decided to cut a deal with federal prosecutors and revealed where almost every penny was stashed and every body was buried. Writing in 2006, Weeks recalled, "I had known all along, however, that it was not to be easy for anyone to capture Jimmy. If he had saw them coming, he would take them with him. He wouldn't hesitate. Even before he went on the run, he was always said, let it all go to hell together. Let's all go to hell together." And he meant it. "I also knew that Jimmy wouldn't go to trial. He'd rather plead out to a life sentence than put his family through the embarrassment of a trial. If he had a gun on him, he would go out with a blaze of glory rather than spend the rest of his life in jail. But I don't think they'll ever catch him." Now, during this time frame of his, during the manhunt, they have actually, the FBI ended up, because this is not part of it. And this information they're putting up here is garbage compared to what 60 Minutes did on the Bulger capture and the manhunt. He was literally in Louisiana for a time. He was in Chicago. He was in New York. That's true. He did go to Florida for a time. And what was fascinating, what got him actually captured, and I'll skip all the details on this because it's just a big flabbergaster and stuff. But what actually got him captured is they went after Catherine Gregg. And what had happened was, is Catherine Gregg got a boob job. They found the doctor that did the boob job and got photos of her, because they didn't really have very clear photos of Bulger. They went after her and eventually found her out through see if I can find where they found it out. I knew it was in California. San Dimas, California. And what had actually ended up happening was they found her out, and during the capture, it was kind of funny. During the capture, what Bulger said, that he basically wasn't on his game. And what ended up happening was someone they advised the manager of the hotel that he was at to basically call him up, tell him that his lock off of his storage unit was broken into, and they had to go down and check and see if there was anything there. Even one of the ladies that was at the apartment complex with Bulger, as Bulger got arrested, was like, "Hey, you might want to hold off. He has dementia." That he went on the fact that he might have dementia, all kinds of stuff. He was living this lie to safeguard himself from being captured. And he literally said, "It's like, if I was 20 years younger, you wouldn't even captured me by this stupidity." And when they were going over his stuff in the apartment complex, they had in the walls, they had $800,000, like a year's worth of supplies in there. Because they very, very rarely went out. They very rarely did anything. The one of the cops actually said, "Is like, hey, why is there socks on this detergent?" And it was one of those big vials of liquid detergent. He's like, "Well, we got the socks from Dollar Tree, and they basically cuff up on my leg." He's like, "You literally go to the Dollar Tree. You have all this money. You're going to Dollar Tree." I was like, "I gotta make every penny count." So it was very weird and surreal to see all this. And like I said, he did not want to be captured for anything, and he was actually thinking of actually going in and going to Arizona to one of the caves there and just dying there if it was his last thing. But Bulger was eventually indicted and put in federal prison, but he died in prison. Bulger was transferred to federal transfer center in Oklahoma City to U.S. Penitentiary Hanson in the West Virginia on October 29th, 2018. So this is a very young case. At 8:20 a.m. October 30th, the 89-year-old Bulger was found dead. Bulger was in his wheelchair and had been beaten to death by multiple inmates armed with a sock, wrap, padlock, and a shiv. Yeah, his eyes had been nearly bludgeoned out, and his tongue was almost cut off. And the law enforcement officials described Bulger as unrecognizable. This was the third homicide in this prison for a 40-day span. correctional officer had warned Congress just days before the most recent Hazleton death that the facility had been dangerously understaffed. Geese 51 and his brother was sentenced to life in prison in 2011, and their roles in severe and violent crimes included 2003 killing of Fredo Big Al Brano of the Genovese. Genovese crime family capo, who was shot in a Springfield, Massachusetts parking lot. According to ABC News, Bulger's medical status had been lowered on October 8th, 2018, shortly after his transfer. Basically, he was mauled in prison. So, he ended up dying really horribly. But his actual sentence, when he was put in a sentence, was two life sentences plus 5 years, forfeiture of 25.2 million and $19.8 million in restitution. I don't know if he had the money or not. Probably had the money. Who knows? So, anyways, that's James Joseph Whitey Bulger Jr. He literally was a horrible man, but he was an intelligent crime boss, kind of a kingpin of Boston. Anyways, everybody, thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. If you have any questions or anything, comment below if you made it this far. Thank you all.